Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Muhammad Abraham. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and of course, all podcast platforms. Go check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get all of our amazing premium content you can't see anywhere else. You can get our regular shows and all the content from every creator on Rockfin. And check out the new awesome podcasts by the Forbidden Knowledge Network, such as Inception, Raised by Giants, Day Zero, Understanding Propaganda, and so many more. You can get them all in one place, our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. And finally, guys, check out C60 Purple Power. You hear me talk about it almost every show. It may be the most powerful antioxidant known to man. You can get C60 for your pets. Your pets can feel great, too. Go ahead and check it out by clicking the link in the description. You can get 10% off your order plus free shipping. See what C60 can do for you and turn your health around today. Today, I want to welcome Muhammad Abraham. He is an Egyptologist, hieroglyphics expert, tour guide, and director. Inspired by an equally passionate desire to share his wisdom, he offers a wide spectrum of knowledge regarding the history, arts, literature, and culture of the ancient Egyptians. He has been working as a tour guide and a teacher of hieroglyphics since 2000. His comprehensive knowledge of ancient Egypt, along with his background in comparative religions and spiritual studies, has enabled him to fill lecture halls and conduct a variety of successful tours over the years. When he is not on tour, he frequently lectures on Egyptian mythology, its spiritual aspects in Egyptian art, and the ancient Egyptian concept of gods and goddesses. Muhammad, welcome. How are you doing?
How are you, Matt? How are you, Chris? I'm very good.
I'm excellent.
And Greetings from Egypt.
What's that?
Greetings from Egypt.
Sorry, you were breaking up. Yes, thank you so much. And I had the honor of meeting you at the 2020 UFO MegaCon, where you had a fascinating presentation. It was really one of my favorites when we went to that conference. And there are so many shows and guests that the topic of Egypt and its surrounding mysteries that always comes up, especially on my show. It's one of my favorite topics, and it's such an important place in the extraordinary and magical history that has come out of Egypt. It's one of my favorite things to discuss. And now this is your first time on. I'd love to hear more and the audience tell more about your background and what ultimately led you down this amazing path.
Okay, my hometown is called Badrashin. Badrashin, this is one of the cities of Giza Governorate. It's like a small state in Egypt. And when we say Giza, so we are talking about the most famous sites like Giza Plateau, the pyramids of Giza, Saqqara, Abu Sir, Dahshur, Memphis, Abu Jurab. So imagine that the backyard of our house was all of these pyramids and sites and ancient structures. So from a very young age, I was joining my primary school. Like I remember exactly when I was at the fourth grade, I was like 10 years old, our school took us to a journey to Saqqara. And that was my first time to see the ancient sites. And guess what? My first site inside Saqqara was the Serapeum, was all the megalithic boxes and the underground galleries. So immediately I felt like there is something very, very important and very ancient is hidden in these boxes or under the ground. Maybe it was like the imagination of a child, but I was very connected to Saqqara. So by time I took the chance and joined every school trip to sites like Saqqara, like Giza. I wasn't attracted to go to the zoo or to the amusement park. No, I was attracted to go to the ancient sites. So after high school, I decided to go to the College of Tourism, where I started to become a tour guide. And to become a tour guide in Egypt, it is not just a person who speaks a foreign language and can take the tourist in a nice tour. No, tour guide in Egypt is somebody who studies and got a bachelor degree in ancient Egyptian history and language, architecture, and not only ancient Egyptian. And from this, part, I want to make sure that people understand the difference between Egyptian tour guide and Egyptologist. Egyptologist is the one who studied only ancient Egypt. But the tour guide, and that's why I always feel proud to be called also tour guide, that I studied ancient Egypt, Greco-Roman Egypt, Coptic Egypt, Islamic Egypt, and modern Egypt. So all the history of all the Egyptian civilizations. That's why when I talk with you and with many other people, and when I make connections between stories and between evidences, I know what I'm talking about, because I studied the chain of civilization, not just ancient Egypt and said, and that's it. And beside this chain of civilizations, I studied ancient Egyptian language, which mistakenly we call it hieroglyphic, because you must understand this is a separate study. When you say Egyptologist, it is not necessarily to understand or to believe that the Egyptologist can understand hieroglyphics or can read it. No, that is a separate study, okay? Because you can spend years studying this and trying to understand the ancient Egyptian language. I was lucky to be a student of one of the giants in this language, called Egyptian doctor, called Dr. Nur ed-Din. He passed away 3 years ago. So I was a very good student. I was able to understand the language in a good way, which opened so many gates for me to understand in a better way the meanings of so many Egyptian words and so many Egyptian sentences. Because when it was translated into English or French or German languages, the meaning was lost. Or let's say the meaning was not accurate. But when I used my the local way to understand the ancient Egyptian, I figured out so many secrets. Like, I will give you a quick example. The word Stargate, for most of the academics, and I studied to be an academic, many people will tell you that to believe in stargates, that is something like very fancy imagination.
Yes.
But right. when you are able to read hieroglyphics in a good way, you will find a symbol called star. We call it Seb. And then another symbol, it's like a door frame or a gate shape. So there is no way to read it something else. It must read as stargate. Right. And then when you understand that there is something like this is written on the walls of the Egyptian temples, not all of them, few of them in certain spots, then you start finding more details about that word star gates. Sometimes it is stars gate. Sometimes it is great star gate. So you will be familiar with something like this. Okay. So this is one of the benefits of to be an expert in, or not, it's not a must to be an expert, but at least a good student of ancient Egyptian language.
That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely want to get into some of the discoveries you made with hieroglyphics, but I want to start as far back as ancient Egyptian history as we can go. I'm talking pre-dynastic, the most advanced civilizations and furthest back that we can go. How far back do you think these ultra-advanced civilizations have gone based on the evidence you've seen and collected over the years?
Okay, look, I have a very nice, maybe short story for you. So I want you to be patient with me. If we ask this question to many groups, okay, of researchers and scholars, how old is the Egyptian civilization? So the first group will be the Egyptologist and will tell you the Egyptian civilization is between 3,500 and 4,000 BC, okay? Based on what? Based on the written history by some of the old writers, Greek writers, and one of the Egyptian priests called Manetun. He lived in the second century BC. So the first group, Egyptologists, will say 3,500 to 4,000 BC. And then the second group will be also Egyptologists, but they had some knowledge with evidences from prehistory and early man tools. So they are going to tell you, no, it will be like 4000 BC to 7000 BC, based on some discoveries for earlier cultures in Egypt. And we found their remains, we found their products, pottery, we found things made out from animal bones and ivory. Okay. If you ask geologists, they will, the third group, they will tell you, no, there was a civilization before 9700 BC. Why? Because they found evidences of the flood after the last ice age on some of the structures like the Sphinx and like some other places all over Egypt. So if you ask other groups, and by the way, there will be also Egyptologists like a Belgium expedition. They were working in the south of Egypt in a place called Nazlet Khater. They found a skeleton. First, another place called El Kobaneya area. They found a skeleton from 17 to 28,000 years ago. So because of the carbon dating was not accurate. So it was like 17,000 to 28,000 years old, okay? But the Belgium expedition made, when they found another skeleton at Nazlet Khater, Nazlet Khater near Abydos in the south of Egypt, and they made a very precise examination, and the skeleton is 35,000 years old. And then another expedition, they found a skeleton for a young boy. So the first two skeletons for adults, like 20 years old. The third skeleton was found for a child like 8 years old. And guess what? 55,000 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'm not finished yet. Back to those Egyptologists who have a good background about geology. Okay, so I will take you in a big step backwards. They found some tools from Flint over the hills and mountains of the Valley of the Kings at Luxor. And guess what? It is 500,000 years old.
Oh, wow.
Again, 500,000 years old.
That's amazing.
Okay? Is that the oldest we have? No, my friend, we have older. So I want you to be ready for this great surprise. And I'm about to finish my first book, okay?
Oh,
and I stated this last information. It was my final information about how old the Egyptian history, with evidences. So we are not just it is not imagination, because in other cases, I may give you an answer according to star constellations, according to some alignments, okay? But we are talking about what? About physical evidences, okay?
Yeah.
So according to the Egyptian Museum of Civilization, they have a list of the prehistoric man and his tools, okay? So the pre-last section is the 500,000 years old. Guess what? The last section is 2.3 million years old.
Oh, wow. That is extraordinary.
It's not me.
Yeah.
It is the administration of the Egyptian Civilization Museum, or the Egyptian Museum of Civilization. This is a newly opened museum. They made a long list of the tools and the shape of the tools, and they put a big tool from Flint, like a big axe, and they say that this is 2.3 million years old. I was in Siwa Oasis 5 years ago. Siwa Oasis, northwest of Egypt, and the Bedouin, our local guide there, told me, I will take you to a special place, and he took me to a place full of fossils. And it used to be and like an ancient muddy ground, but the mud is petrified. So he pointed at some kind of footprints, and he told me there was a German expedition working here, and they said these footprints are 2 million years old. I was like in the middle of believing him or disbelieving him, but with the evidence I just told you about at the museum, so now the two stories can fit with each other. So we have now evidences, or let's say verified evidences, that there was human lived in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, at 2,300,000 years ago.
That's amazing. Now, the skeletons that were found to be 500,000 years or older, were these modern Homo sapiens skeletons, or did they have any strange anomalies, or
what were... No, Homo sapiens sapiens, yes.
Wow, that is great. So these were advanced skeletons, and the tools that were found were pretty advanced. I mean, to be able to build an axe, you know, it takes a
very little... good. Now we come to this interesting part. Okay, so do we have any evidence that those people were advanced? Physical evidences, no, but we are using our logic. So let's go back to the first story about the what we call it pre-dynastic, which is 7000 BC. We are sure that before the dynasties, before King Khufu and Narmer and those kings, there was a group of primitive ancient Egyptians. And those people developed from using mud and pottery and using manual tools till having a huge and good advanced civilization, okay? According to the timeline, it took them like 3,000 years to develop, right? So how about the 2.3 million years ago? They needed more than 2 million years to develop from using flint stone to use mud or pottery. It doesn't make sense. So you get my point?
Yeah.
So according to the first example, every 5,000 years, we have a development. If we start from zero, if we are talking of a group of people, had zero knowledge, zero civilization. So they need like 5,000 years to develop to become very advanced nation. Okay, so my guessing that every and they're gonna last for let's say 3,000 years. So every 8,000 years we have a civilization, and according to the equinox cycle, which it says that the cycle of and this is one of my future topics. I talk about the five cycles of the sun. Each cycle is 24,000 years. 12,000 development and 12,000 devolution. So evolution and devolution. So 12,000 and 12,000. So the cycle is 12,000 years. So that is my guessing. Every 24,000, we expect a separate civilization. And that civilization will have two parts. Part one will be civilization, great civilization. Part two will be the curve will go down and decline. Okay, so you can count from now backwards till you reach 2.3 million years ago. So we have thousands of civilizations. So I'm not talking about one or two or ten. No, I'm talking about thousands of ancient advanced civilizations.
Wow, and the possibilities of the technologies that have could have been going on throughout those advanced civilizations is fascinating. And that's kind of what I want to get to is the biggest mysteries. One of the biggest mysteries about Egypt is the Giza Plateau and the pyramids and its construction, the purpose for it. And I'd like to get your insights into some of that. First being, you know, what do you believe was the purpose for the Giza pyramid?
Look, when you go to Giza Plateau and you see the three major pyramids, the first, what we call it, the Great Pyramid, and the second and the third, every component and every item, every angle, every stone is unbelievable. And there is, like, for sure, it must be high technology and great knowledge behind the design, behind the project, behind everything. We cannot claim that these things were made even by our modern civilization. with our modern technology, we are going to suffer too much to finish this project.
Yeah.
And it will take trillions of dollars, and it will take, like, in my opinion, too long time, more than 50 years, okay? And we may not get the same result, okay? To understand the function of the pyramid, we must understand the challenges of building the pyramid. Because I always say the income is always depending on the effort, how much effort you pay, okay? Because if the income is weak, so you don't pay much effort, right? If you work a hard work for just $5, no, it doesn't make sense, okay? But if they will tell you you're gonna get $5,000, then you will do your best. So to understand the benefit of the pyramid, we must understand the challenges. So we are talking about almost 2,300,000 blocks of stones. Okay, some people say 2,600,000, but I can say totally 3 million blocks, because we are missing so many blocks, especially the casing stone. So 3 million blocks. The average of the blocks is 1.5 tons. Okay, from 1.5 tons to 5 tons. And there are some 70 tons and 100 tons, okay? So imagine that the ancient Egyptian had to cut and shape and transfer 3 million blocks to Giza Plateau and then built it, okay? I just feel dizzy trying to do this calculation when you talk about 3 million blocks,
yeah.
Okay? And they built those blocks in a very precise way. The chances of mistakes is almost zero, okay? What I'm talking about, like the first layer, okay? The maybe the widths of each stone is not the same. They are not the same widths, okay? But the height of all the blocks is the same. And the first stone on the right side is the same height of the last stone on the left side, or if we can talk east and west, okay? This distance is 223 meters. Guess what? If the first stone will be just 1 millimeter wrong or higher, okay? Just 1 millimeter. And you know what is 1 millimeter? Just like a scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
And the second one will be 2 millimeters, which, by the way, accepted in constructions, okay? That percentage is accepted. So the angle or the line at the end will be 23 centimeters. And will be obvious, a big mistake, okay? But what we realize that this kind of percentage doesn't exist in the Great Pyramid. The chances of mistakes is like 0.001, okay?
Wow.
And the same for the upper cores and the upper cores and the up until the end of the pyramid. Going inside the pyramid, there is a tunnel. Like there is a door from the middle of the pyramid going deep under the pyramid, under the bedrock. So it doesn't go only till the base of the pyramid. No, it crosses the bedrock and it goes deeper under the bedrock. So also that is another great challenge. Why that? And that kind of tunnel was made before they built the base of the pyramid or after? So many questions. Okay, and then from that descending passage, there is in the first 5 meters, there is an ascending passage going up. And there is a room in the middle, mistakenly called, of course, the Queen's Pyramid, the Queen's Room. That is a big mistake. And then another room higher called the King's Room. And that one, the last one, is very interesting because it is completely covered from inside with granite. And this is now the blocks I mentioned earlier that weighing 50, 70, and 100 tons, okay? So we are not talking about the heavier blocks to be on the base, which is like considered as an easier job. Of course, it's not easy at all, but easier job than being in a high in a height like 70 or 80 meters high. How they left these blocks that level.
Okay. Yeah.
So back to the story of the function of the pyramid. Okay.
Sure.
If the pyramid was just a structure in the middle of the desert, we would say anything. It could be a tomb, it could be like a vault, could be anything. But no, the pyramid was built in a certain spot. You know what? If this pyramid cannot be 1 meter east or 1 meter south or 1 meter north or 1 meter west, it must be at that specific spot. Why? Because the second pyramid also was designed to be in a specific spot. That's why the main diameter crossing crosses the diameter of the base of the pyramid is the same one crosses the base of the second pyramid. Okay. And guess what? Most of the people will think that maybe it does the same to the third pyramid. It crosses the base. No, it doesn't cross the base. It touches the outer angle of the base of the third pyramid. So again, we are looking to a very restricted design. They cannot move 1 inch forward or back. Okay. And that's why when you visit the second pyramid, you will find that, of course, if you have a good guide and will show you what I'm talking about, that the base of that pyramid or the ground before building the pyramid is what I call it the worst location ever, because it's a sloping angle. So you don't go to a place like this and build your structure. No, you will try to find a wide, flat ground, which is very close, by the way. Okay, a few meters to the west side, there is a flat ground. So why they choose the worst spot and they didn't go to the flat ground? Because the location also is very important. So now we are talking about what? About design, because I'm going to tell you my according to my observations, because of like thousands of times visiting these sites. So I managed to put four rules. If those four rules existed in any structure, the place will be active and the energy will be received. Okay. What is the first rule? Is the location. Not any location, it's a certain location. And that location is depending on something under the ground. Okay. And then we come to the second law, which is the alignment. Okay. So the location on the ground, the alignment with something at the sky. And that thing will be a constellation, a certain star. Okay. And the design and the material. Okay. That's why you will see some structures built to be pyramids, other structures, obelisks, another structure, temple. That is the design. Some structures were built entirely from limestone, other structures from granite, other structures from mix, limestone and granite. And then we have completely different group of structures built from sandstone. So what we are talking about here, we are talking about certain material is serving certain function. So now we come to the conclusion. What are the functions of the pyramid? To be honest, if I tell you one function, I will be completely wrong. There are, in my opinion, so many functions to the pyramids and to the ancient Egyptian sites in general. So we can count with me, healing. It produces energy. That energy can be used for healing, can be used to enhance the abilities and the nature of herbs and seeds and plants, okay? It can be used to ionize the water. And ionized water can be used to heal the body also, to heal the skin, to heal so many diseases also like cancer. The pyramid is producing microwaves, can be used for communications, okay? And someone can like say communications like we do nowadays. Yes, why not? Communications with each other, or maybe like in a bigger scale, okay? Serve as a place to absorb negative energies, okay? And when we come to this part, we must talk about the obelisk and we must talk about granite. Granite is playing like a big magnet to absorb negative energies from the body and recharge the person with positive energies, okay? That's why when you like do a very good research about how the ancient Egyptians used granite, you will find very interesting facts. Fact number one, that they, in Egypt, we have so many kinds of granite, okay? But they focused on a certain type, which is what we call it the Aswanian granite, the rose granite from Aswan. We have granite at the Eastern Desert. We have granite at Sinai. We have also granite quarries at Aswan, but it is not rose. It is black granite or gray granite, but they used rose granite much. You know why? Because rose, all the granite, all the types of granite contains crystal quartz in the molecular structure. But rose granite contains the most, contains from 20 to 60%. So as if rose granite is a big piece of crystal. So that's why they were building their constructions from rose granite most of the time. So that is the reason that we are talking about healing energy because of the granite.
Yeah, and I would imagine that the discoveries that are being made right now about the Giza Plateau and the pyramid and all the things that you're just talking about, it could be a huge threat to, you know, mainstream big oil corporations. If, you know, it could offer free energy and healing to the world. So I'm sure there are some people that wouldn't want these secrets getting out. Do you have any kind of pushback from any institutions or academia for the things that you're talking about?
No, look, I can tell you that there is nothing like this at all. But yes, I agree with you that they don't support any kind of research to prove the what we are saying. They don't give any chances to do analysis, to use science to know what is behind or what is underneath. Because as you said, if we manage to turn on these sites and it will be, as we say, huge engines for this kind of energy. So we will not need any medicine or those kind of tablets anymore. So we're going to have free healing, free communication for free, free energy. Okay. So, of course, many people are going to lose their business because of this. They will lose their income. So I'm not sure that, but I think they are behind the ways to block or to close the door in front of alternative researchers. Yeah. But there is no threat. I don't think so. There is no any things like from let's say I don't know how to say it, but. The situation is okay because they control the media, okay? So I think they talk against what we are saying and they always try to blame us. Like I will give you an example. Here in Egypt, if you talk about something like this and you say that the pyramids are older than the dynasties, the first accusation is going to be like, you want to relate this civilization to non-Egyptian people? You want to relate this to the Atlantean civilization? Are you Egyptian? Are you true? Like this, okay? So this is something of what we face. But a media claim or a media attack. But any physical things or threats, no. they are good in this field, in
Well,
this
that's
part.
good. At least there's not come to that point. Now, you mentioned earlier the precision cuts and the moving of enormous stones. Any insights into how this was done and what kind of technology could make these cuts?
Okay, this is very, very important question. Okay, and again, most of the people, they are not aware with what size of blocks we have in Egypt. And I'm talking about the blocks which already used to make sites, to build, to be parts of the part of, to be part of certain sites, or to be used as statues, okay? So let's start with the smallest one, 1.5 tons, okay? It's like a cube of limestone, and it was used to build some pyramids and some temples. So this is, in my opinion, the 1.5 and till the 1.4 tons, this is the popular size of blocks. But wait a minute. This is not the whole case now. In some places, okay, we have many, and I'm not talking about just one or two. I'm talking about like sometimes 50 blocks, talk about 100 blocks. They're exceeding the size of 20 tons, okay, one piece of a stone. And I will come later to the challenges to cut one piece of a stone with this size. That is another story, okay? And then in other sites, we have also many blocks exceeding the size of 50 tons. Other places, we have many blocks exceeding the size of 100 tons. Like the Serapeum, as an example, most of the boxes inside the Serapeum are between 70 and 100 tons. Okay. So that's it. No, we have. Like the obelisk and so many statues are exceeding the size or the weight of 300 tons. And then we have some structures or pieces of stones in one piece exceeding the weight of 700 tons. And we have 1,000 tons and we have 1,200 tons. So we started with 1.5.
Yeah.
Now we're reaching 1,200 tons. Okay. So any story I can tell you, or any mainstream story about how they cut and lift and push 1.5 blocks, that kind of small block. Okay, accept it. Okay, I don't mind any story, even 5 tons, no problem. But when it comes to a block 20 tons, no, we must say, wait a minute. We are talking about 20 tons. But we can, again, don't mind this, okay? But when it comes to 100 tons, no, 100 tons. Because what are the ways they are talking about? They are talking about a primitive way to push the stone over wood, over gliders, okay, or sledge, and they have like round pieces of trees. And by the way, we don't have this kind of good quality of trees. We have sycamore trees, which is not good, or balm trees. They will not fit this story. But imagine when you put 100 tons above this sledge, it will like push it hard to the ground. So it will stuck with the ground. So if they manage to push the sledge, okay, you know, when you push something over sandpaper, it will start losing material. It will be, as we call it, eaten. Okay, so after 50 meters forward, the sledge will disappear. Okay, will be deteriorated completely. And that is if we talk about solid ground. But the case in many sites is sandy ground, which is harder and harder. Okay, so with the 100 tons, and by the way, this is not the maximum we have. We have, as I said, bigger and heavier. It will push the sledge to sunk to sink into the sand, and no way to push it forward or backwards. Okay. And even if we agree about this imaginary story, and they finished their trip to the site, okay, and then they built the first course. What about the second? How they lift this piece? What about the third, the fourth? Okay, we need cranes. We need because no way to talk about using pulleys or using any primitive techniques, because we are not talking about 2 tons or 3 tons. We are talking about 100 tons. Okay. And then the question will be like very good, strong, and very huge when it comes to the obelisk. One long piece, some of the obelisks more than 20 meters long, okay? And it is one piece. You know what does it mean? That, yes, this is granite, but it's still not steel, still not wood. So the molecular structure is not very strong. It is the density of the stone is different, especially when it has lots of quartz. Or any mistake with the balance of this long piece, it will be cracked. And that was the case with hundreds of obelisks were being removed to be taken out outside Asia. And because they were not following, you know, we have thousands of that. So how could they claim that the ancient Egyptians did the same technique in the first place? So that technique was exactly the technique was used by tomb raiders and treasure hunters in the beginning of the 19th century and the 20th century. That the technique they claim, that the technique was used by pulling down the obelisk with ropes and dragging the obelisk. That technique was the main reason to destroy hundreds of Egyptian obelisks. So how can we claim it is the same technique was used to build these obelisks? Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, what do you think was the actual technique that they were using to move these and erect these blocks?
Yes. Okay. If And I know that some people will agree with me about this. Look, let's say we have a list of options, okay? All of them are not good, are not efficient. But there is one, I know it is very strange, but this is the only logical possible way, which is anti-gravity solution. So they must have anti-gravity. Because again, when we talk about the challenges, sometimes we skip step one and step two, and we focus on step three. And I will bring the example of the obelisk again. So many people, when they start talking about the obelisk, they imagine that the obelisk is already there somewhere on flat ground, and they are taking the obelisk to the temple. No, my friend. Then we are missing step one and step two. What is step one and step two? Step one, how they took the obelisk from that deep level from the quarry. And they took it out of the quarry, and then they send it from the quarry location to the Nile or to the temple. So step one is missing, step two is missing. So when you go to the quarry, the Aswanian quarry of rose granite, there is what we call it the unfinished obelisk. Okay, you know what? Step one here can be like five steps, not just one step. No, it will be like five steps, because you will find that the obelisk is in a deep level. Okay, so you need first to lift up the obelisk, and you're still inside the quarry. You didn't go outside yet. So you need to lift up the obelisk and walk with the obelisk, not outside also the quarry, but you have to, like, if I can say it in a comic way, you have to jump with the obelisk because the ground is not flat. There is higher cliffs and lower cliffs and very sharp cliffs. So you have to jump with the obelisk, okay? And you have to maneuver with the angles and the sharp edges of the quarry until you take the obelisk safe outside the quarry. What if we use modern technology to do this? So we are going to use giant cranes. How many cranes? I'm not sure, but they must be more than four cranes. But four cranes are enough to do the whole job? No, four cranes at work. And then when they move the obelisk, let's say, and rebuild, assemble them in a further distant location, and then they move the obelisk like 10 meters again, and then dismantle the cranes and then reassemble. So every 10 meters, we need to do a job, a separate job to dismantle and reassemble the cranes, which will take like from 10 days to 20 days, dismantling and reassembling what we call giant cranes. It will take at least 10 days, from 10 to 20 days, okay? So imagine every 10 meters, we need 20 days extra. And when I say giant crane, okay, look, the crane is working with pallets. If the crane is lifting 1 ton, so they need to do the preparation to be 2 tons, okay? But what about if this is to be just up and down, okay? But if the crane will lift the 1 ton and move forward, then it must be prepared to be 10 times. So the first example, double size or double weight, but the second example must be 10 times, okay? They call it the counterweight. So the counterweight must be 10 tons. So if we are talking about 1,000 tons, we need a crane prepared with a counterweight, 100, I said, was 100 tons, we need a crane prepared with 1,000 tons. So 100 tons, and the other side, 1,000 tons. And if we talk about 1,000 tons, so we need 10,000 tons. So yeah. Do we have this crane? Okay. And I'm sure we don't have this crane. I think we have cranes till 400 tons, maybe 600 tons,
right?
But no more than this. And I can tell you, I was a bear witness to some of the projects are being done in Egypt now, and they are trying to make the traffic easier. So they build some bridges, okay? And when they cross a major street, they bring one piece, that the part of the bridge will be one piece of metal, okay? It's about maybe 20 meters long. I was bear witness to one day to see four huge cranes are lifting up this metal part of the bridge. So I went to ask the engineer, how heavy is this piece? He told me, guess what? He told me 40 tons. Just 40, okay?
Yeah.
So four big cranes to lift 40 tons.
Yeah, it's so, quite extraordinary.
End of conversation.
Yeah, I remember in your presentation in 2020, you were showing what looked like engine parts and advanced machinery artifacts of these items. And if they had the technology to do some sort of anti-gravity, of course they would have technology to do laser precision cuts and no telling what else. You were showing stuff that looked like advanced engine parts and technology.
Exactly. There is a piece in the Egyptian museum. We call it the chest disc. Okay. I see it as a copy from the original fan. It looks like a fan. Look, what is gravity? Gravity is it's a kind of magnetic power for Earth. Okay. And the ancient Egyptians, in my opinion, they were knowledgeable in magnetism and electromagnetic fields. So I think it is like very ideal to say if the ancient Egyptians were masters in this kind of field. So if they manage to spot or to frequency, they can stop magnetism in this location. Okay. So that item at the Egyptian Museum, it looks like a very, very strange fan. And it's not only the shape of the fan, but the history of the fan. The label says that this object was found inside one of the tombs of the first dynasty. And this will lead us to talk about the, again, lost civilization. First dynasty, in all history books, they talk about first dynasty as primitive time. Okay, still very close to pre-dynastic. They still deal with pottery. They still have no real civilization. So how come they managed to create this piece? And by looking to the, by seeing this piece, you will understand that it must be done with very delicate tools, because the material is not very strong, and the material is very thin, and the shapes of the fan or the, those angles is very delicate. You know, any extra pressure will break by advanced tools. So Dynasty One had advanced tools? No. So when they, this piece could happen before Dynasty One, not after. Of course, not after, not the, the time of the fourth dynasty or the New Kingdom time. So before Dynasty One. So how come? So this is one of the evidences we use that there was an advanced civilization before the Egyptian dynasties. So this shape of the fan, in my opinion, was, this is not the whole machine. This is part of the machine. And we think that the machine was producing a kind of ultrasonic energy. And the ultrasonic or the sound waves was responsible to delete or to stop the magnetism of Earth at certain locations, so they will be able to levitate the blocks or the stones.
Man, that is fascinating. I want to get to what you were talking about earlier about the translation of hieroglyphics into basically saying that stargates. Now, there are all around the world, there's these structures that look like doors that go to nowhere on the sides of mountains or built into megalithic structures. Do you think there's some sort of connection there with what could be called a stargate?
Of course. And you know, what you just just referring to, like there is one in Peru, that shape of gate is as carving. It is exactly the same design, okay? So I think that the advanced ancient civilization was not just local to a certain place. No, it was global civilization. And people were contacting each other and communicating with each other. Okay, and I'm not sure what I am response of the audience. I also believe that humans one day, they were not just located on Earth only. They maybe were outside the planet and communicating with each other. Okay, because you will find that the ancient Egyptians were very knowledgeable about our galaxy, and they named Jupiter, they named Saturn, they named, of course, many stars and many constellations, as if this was a very easy knowledge for them, okay? Not just something like fancy and it is not easy to explain. No, they were talking about it in a very easy way, and they were talking about what we call it, call them the deacons. 10 stars appear every day, and they last for 10 days, okay? And that's why they managed to understand that we have 360 days for the year, because they rotate, and there are 36 groups. So there was a huge subject about the universe and about space Okay. So when I say Stargate, no, it is not just a simple, simple or a simple design. No, there is huge data behind what I call it Stargate.
That's awesome. Now, you said that we could have possibly had the technology to traverse the stars through this Stargate technology. Do you think that we had the technology as well to reach flight and possibly beyond with what we had at that time?
Yes. Look, when you think about or when you look to the ancient Egyptian writings, okay, you will find that there are so many things we used to think it is a kind of fancy writings, fancy designs. Like when they represent a human with wings, okay, when they represent a bird with a human head, when they represent what we call them the netters, which mistakenly was explained as the word God. Netter is not God. Netter is nature. So that element of nature is power, is energy, but it is not deity, is not a God as they claim in Egyptology. The ancient Egyptians in the writings talk about another type of life. They call it the afterlife. So also in our explanation, we think that this is after death. No, it could be during the first life. So why we call it after death? Okay. If you go to Karnak Temple, you will see in the last end of the location of the temple, a carving for what we call it gate. And we know the shape of the gate, but this is a very special gate. It is not just one gate. There are seven gates inside each other. Seven gates. And number seven was repeated in ancient Egypt many times. And we have what we call it seven skies and seven earths. Okay. So as if number seven is important for portals. Okay. As I told you earlier, in Dendera Temple, we have a shape of a gate with many stars, not just one or two. There are there is a gate on the left side of the door, has, I think, eight stars. And on the other side of the door, the gate has 13 stars. So we are not talking about just one star gate. No, we are talking about one gate to many stars. And in other locations, we have one star, one gate. So that is a gate for one star. And then we have, as I told you, at Hatshepsut Temple, we have the title Great Star Gate. So that is different from the normal Stargate. So we have another Stargate, but it is maybe bigger or had great energy. That's why they give it the title Great Stargate. Some people will tell you, no, Muhammad is saying this in a different way. That was a title for the king. Also is still very interesting how we understand or why they call the king Stargate. So this king was connected with Stargates. Maybe not the site, maybe it is the person himself or the knowledge of this person. So either this case or that case, the meaning is still the same. So there was Stargates in ancient Egypt.
That's great.
Of course, I'm not saying or I'm not trying to make you believe or to say that the Stargate, like what we see in movies and people will cross to a certain. No, we are not sure yet what is the result or what is the function of the Stargate. But it is something very clear. It is connected with stars.
Yeah, and one thing I want to close on today is the gods and goddesses of Egypt. Do you think that these were actual entities, beings that could have possibly been from the stars? I know a lot of this is based on astrology and astrotheology, but do you think that some of these gods were real beings, entities?
No, I don't see this way because I according to my observations and studies and my personal observations and beliefs, no. The word Neter is the origin of the word nature. And I can see that the ancient Egyptians were masters in watching every natural element and trying to see the effect of this element, the good effect and the bad effect, and how to use the good effect and how to avoid the bad effect. Or maybe later in the Dark Ages, how to attack their enemies with the bad effect of this kind of energy. I will give you an example. The sun. You will find that we have a name for a god called Ra. Ra, the sun god. Okay. But most of the people who also don't have a good idea about the hieroglyphics and they don't read all the labels in a good way, we have another sun god called Atum or Atum. So Ra is a sun god or Atum is a sun god. But wait a minute, there is the third sun god called Atun, like Akhenaten, the god of Akhenaten, okay. So Atun. And then we have an earlier sun god called Khebr or Khebr. And then we have the fifth sun god called Amun. All of them, so they are not the sun gods. They are aspects of the sun. Khebr is the sun during the morning. Ra, the sun during Khebr, the sun during the dawn time, the sunrise. Ra, the sun during the moon, the morning. Atum during the noon. Atun during the afternoon. And Amun during the sunset. Okay. So the ancient Egyptian realized this and they understood that the sun in this time has certain energy. So it will be good if you expose to the sun. If the sun will touches your skin. But in a certain time and maybe certain alignment. But Atun, the afternoon sun, they say no, that to be exposed to the sun or the your skin will be connected or will be the sun will affect your skin in a bad way. So avoid going to the sun. Amun, there is a sun, but we don't see it. So they call it the hidden sun. That's why the name Amun means the hidden. And you know what? When they built temples and people used to go to the temples for healing, every day was a good day for healing. But there were certain days, they were the best days for healing. So every day like regular days, but certain days. And I managed to understand some of these days like Karnak Temple at the 21st of December. This is the best day to go and to receive the healing energy of the sun of Amun, okay? The 22nd of October to go to Abu Simbel to receive the healing energy of Atum. The 22nd of February, the same place, okay? But yes, every day is okay, but this is the best day. This is the peak of energy. So my belief that all those beings or entities, no, they are representation of the powers and energies of nature.
Yes.
Like wind, like the sun, and by the way, the sun occupies a big part of the Egyptian mythology. Like the cow, like the light, natural elements or items.
That actually makes a lot of sense. And the more I've had so many researchers that are coming to that kind of same understanding about the representation of gods and the things of that nature. And Muhammad, thank you so much. This was amazing. I would love to have you back on when your book comes out. Any ideas when this should be?
Look, I have like 1 week to finish it. I'm still looking for a publisher. Okay, so wish me luck.
Yes, definitely. I'm sure you won't have any problems with that, and I would definitely love to have you on when the book's out and we could talk more because there's so much more we could talk about. This is one of my favorite things, like I said earlier. If people would like to find out more about yourself and the work they're doing, what's the best way that they can do so?
Look, the group called Guide of Egypt.
You were frozen up. You were frozen up there for a couple of minutes there. Just start over after I asked you that.
Okay. They find my group at Facebook called Guide of Egypt, and my website is beautyegypttours.com.
Perfect. Mohammed, thank you so much. Like I said, fantastic information, and we'll definitely talk again very soon.
You are welcome, Chris, and it's an honor to be a guest in your show.
Yes, sir. It's an honor speaking with you. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening, and we will definitely talk again tomorrow.